Hey, welcome back to another episode of Salty Saints Podcast. I'm Zach.
And I'm Randy. And Zach, let me introduce a friend of mine, an old friend of mine to you.
Absolutely.
Bill Kidwell. Bill, when did we first meet?
I would say about 1992.
Okay. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, 100 years ago.
Yeah, it was. It was last century.
I am really excited to hear from you, Bill. We've got some pretty interesting topics in mind today, just really to hear your faith story most of all, but that you are a missionary to the Slavic people, as you said. And so with all of the stuff going on with Russia and Ukraine today, we just do want to be sensitive to that. And so if we get to a question where you're uncomfortable or something answering that, just let us know and we'll glaze over that and move on to the next thing. Does that sound good?
That sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. We want to just make sure that you're you stay true to everybody and love people, you know? So.
Amen.
Cool. So getting started, you want to tell us just about yourself, who you are, how you got started as a missionary in this field?
Well, I am an older person. I'm a senior citizen for sure. So I'll not go all the way back. I'll just go back far enough that we can pick up the interest in the Slavic peoples. And, of course, I was born and raised right here in Indiana. I am a Hoosier.
Okay.
Down the southern part of the state.
Where at?
A little town called Shoals, Indiana.
Oh, no. I'm from Seymour.
That's oh, come on. No way.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know where Shoals is. Huh?
I don't know where
you
Shoals
don't,
is.
Well,
where's Shoals?
Nobody else does either, okay?
My family's from Brownstown.
Well, this is in Martin County, so you have to go
south.
From you south and west.
Okay. Okay. Yeah,
so
I gotcha.
South, directly south of Bedford.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Gotcha.
Mitchell.
Yep. Got it.
Then keep coming west.
Got it, got it.
Right. Yeah. My wife is from Lagodi, which is also in Martin County,
yeah.
More to the west toward Washington.
Okay.
As we say here in Indiana, Washington.
Washington. Washington. That's right.
Yeah. Washington.
We were talking about that the other day.
Yeah, washing our clothes. We put an R in a word where there is no R.
Yeah, so I grew up there. I come from a long line of, on my mother's side, of preachers. My mother married a Catholic, so I was raised as a Catholic, except for the first few years of my life in the Methodist Church. And then I joined the Air Force. I went 1 year to Vincennes University. So I was born in 1947, so that gives you some idea. So I am a baby boomer for sure. my whole life has been, seems like, Russia, and Russian, and Ukraine, the Slavic people. So when I went to Vincennes University, the Vietnam War was getting ready to fire up. I graduated in 1965. I joined the Air Force in 1966, went 1 year to college and just wasn't motivated really. And so I said, well, since the war is going on, I could be drafted. I'm just going to join the Air Force. I'd taken a test by the Air Force back when I was a junior in high school. And I guess I did pretty well. So when I went to the recruiting office, the recruiter said, well, I'm looking at your scores. You qualify to go, you know, whatever career field you want to go into after you go to basic training. So I said, okay, I'll go into electronics. That was the up-and-coming field. And so I got down to basic training, and they said, okay, you guys, after about 3 weeks, they said, okay, you guys that came down here under the electronics program, you could take a language aptitude test, and you might be selected for a language school. And I said, oh, okay, why not? So I took it, and I passed it. And so everybody was getting their orders as to, okay, you're going to go to this kind of school, you're going to go to this tech school, you're going to go to that, you're going to be this, you're going to be that. I get mine, Syracuse University. Russian language intensive program. So at the age of 19, I take off. It was a nine-month program, two full semesters.
Now, for context, what I was told when I was in OMS as a missionary was that Russian is the language of heaven.
Because
it takes an eternity to learn it.
To learn it, that is correct, yes. Yeah, I'm still learning it. So it was a full intensive. All of our professors were themselves PhDs of some within the language of Russian and history. Most of them had immigrated to the United States back during the 30s, during the Stalin purges, and so they were really old. You know, like 60 or 70. yeah. Well, to a 19-year-old kid, that's old,
that
okay?
That is.
So anyway, and we only had one class during the day. We had 6 hours, six 50-minute periods with 10 minutes and then a lunch break, and 6 hours a day, 5 days a week for 9 months.
Wow.
Yeah. And
just studying Russian?
Just only Russian.
Oh, man.
And we lived in our okay barracks is right there at Syracuse University. We had our own little detachment up on Skytop, they called it. That's where I learned to snow ski. Anyway, at Syracuse, New York. I mean, come on. I mean, they get snow.
You know?
Yeah. So I actually struggled the first semester with the language. It was difficult, very difficult. Typically not only 6 hours a day, only one class during the day was in English, and that was the grammar class. And to be honest, that's where I really learned English grammar.
That's
what a participle is. Okay.
Yeah, I'm studying Greek with Randy right now. And what I'm really learning is that I don't know English.
Well, Greek and Russian and Ukrainian, the Slavic languages have a lot of participles.
Yeah.
They use a lot of participles. Past passive participles, you know, like, okay, Randy. Anyway, I know
what that is.
I do too now. But we had our professor Strela Stravinskaya, and she was really one of those. She was so good. She really taught us the grammar really well.
Excellent.
And then we had another course that was since we were in the military, we were going to be working for the Department of Defense and intelligence area eventually, which I did. We had another class called «Воздухе и на земле», which means in the air and on the ground. And that's where we learned all the military terminology, all the, you know, bombs and planes and, you know, turning left, turning right, tanks and whatever. So we had to learn all that terminology. And then we had a composition class. We had a translation class. We had a dialogue class. We had all kinds of stuff. And then on top of that, it was usually at least 3 to 4 hours of homework every night.
Oh, my goodness.
That was a sad few years for you, man.
Well, 9 months.
9 months.
Wow.
I guess.
Yeah. But we also had a class in music, and that was fun. Cool. And learning the old songs and hearing history. And we focused mostly on grammar and comprehension and writing, reading, speaking, all of it.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was a 24 semester hours you crammed into two semesters. Literally, it's on my transcript.
Wow.
When I transferred to IU when we got back and finished up my undergrad there and then went on to Asbury Seminary.
Okay.
But then once we finished that, we had more training. I'll get to the point where I became a Christian. I was sort of I'd grown up in the church. I really wasn't just an all-American, red-blooded American kid, you know. I know now I was a really bad sinner, but, I was just like kind of like average guy, you know. And when I got into the Air Force and I went through the language program, and then we did more training after that. So it was like almost a year and a half before I ever got to the field to actually do what I was supposed to do. So, of course, the enlistment in the Air Force is a minimum of 4 years.
Right.
So they got at least 2.5 years out of it. They were going to get at least 2.5 years. So the first semester was difficult, but about 2 weeks before the end of the first semester, the language and everything and the grammar, everything just kind of came together.
It clicked.
And I went from a C-plus to A-minus overnight. And so I was thankful for that. I fell in love with the Russian language. It's a very musical language. There are harsh aspects to it, some difficult pronunciations. But I dream it. I think it. So anyway, the Russian language just took over my mind. It takes forever to learn it. So anyway, I get to Berlin, Germany as my first duty assignment. I get there in November of 1967, and in the summer, August 20th, 1968, I worked a double shift that day. We intercepted Russian military signals from the Air Force, Russian Air Force. And that was my job, was to collect this and to translate it and to provide information back to our Department of Defense. And some could even go higher, so depending on the situation. And I was there when the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact countries invaded Czechoslovakia. Because they were flying right over the top of us, because Berlin, you know, was sitting inside of East Germany.
Right,
you
know, right.
So,
okay.
Wow. It was a very interesting time. But about a year later is when I came to Christ. I knew a lot about religion. I knew a lot about celebrations and stuff like that. I was an altar boy for 10 years when I was in the Catholic Church. There were times, even when I was younger, that I did feel the touch. I didn't know what it was then, but I then recognized later that the Lord had touched my life several times. And so I was getting ready to get married. My sweet wife now of 52 and a half years.
That's hard to believe.
That's pretty
I'm
good.
Not that old. I mean, I'm only, 12?
For a woman that's only 34, to be married
right.
for 52 years, that's incredible.
You know, people look at us and they say, well, I was 12 and she was 9. And she's been a wonderful, wonderful person in my life, besides being my wife. So she's 18. She flies over to Germany. We get married over there.
Wow.
About 3 weeks before, I was in September. It was January. I proposed to her. In September, she came over, 69, and we got married in Berlin. I'm double hooked, by the way. I got married twice, 3 days apart.
Yeah.
I tell people it didn't work the first time, so I'd do it again. Well, what it was, the law was in Germany, is that you had to get married in the German civil court first.
Okay. Yep.
And then 3 days later, we got married by the chaplain.
In the church.
By the chaplain.
Okay. Yeah. One for the state, one for God, right?
That's right. Exactly right. All three of our children were born there in Germany. But about 3, maybe 4 weeks before Nancy came over for us to get married, I began to reevaluate my life. I began to think, you know, what kind of a father am I going to be? What kind of a husband am I going to be? You know, I'm being honest. I mean, I had fallen into the same trap that a lot of young soldiers overseas do, you know, going to the bars and doing this and that and things I shouldn't have done, and my mom would be ashamed, and so whatever. But I began to research, and I began to think, you know, maybe I ought to reevaluate here. And so during this process, I had already rented an apartment off Post so that I could have a place for Nancy and me to live. And so I was reading some different books, believe it or not. I mean, I'm really confessing here, guys. I mean, I was reading like ESP and telepathy, and and then I thought to myself, well, you know, if I'm going to be honest here, at least I should try to read the Bible or something. Now, in those years, most Roman Catholics, I'm sure it's changed quite a bit now, and I know there were some then didn't really read the Bible much. But I had a friend, a roommate, that he and I went to language school together, and we went to Berlin together, and his mother had sent him a little New Testament, a Gideon New Testament.
Oh, wow.
In one of the little care packages that he got for Christmas. And so I went to him, and I said, hey, you still got that little New Testament your mom sent you? He said, I don't know. What do you want it for? I said, I don't know. I thought I might look at it. You know,
I give it a peek.
Yeah. So we work shift work. So a lot of times I get home at like 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and I didn't want to go to sleep right away. I couldn't go to sleep because I had to go to work at 3 o'clock the next day and work till 3 to 11 shift. So I said, okay, so I was reading a little bit here and a little bit there. And by the time I read through the four Gospels, I said, either this is a bunch of garbage or I'm a really bad sinner. Well, obviously, I chose the second one. And I wasn't at a Bush Harbor. I wasn't at a church. It wasn't an altar call. There wasn't music playing. There was no pastor. There was no teacher. There was no one preaching. But there was this one guy who was a Christian in my unit who came up to me, and he kept witnessing to me a little bit. And he was talking to me and quoting a few scriptures here and there. So I was kind of halfway paying attention to it. But all of a sudden, after I read the four Gospels, I said, you know, I think I need to make a change here. And at work one night, it was like 2 a.m., nobody was around me where we worked in my little unit. You know, there really wasn't a lot of people around, and some of them were over here talking, some of them were half asleep, some of them were drinking coffee, you know, while they're just trying to stay awake. And I just kind of leaned up against kind of one of our machines there, and I just kind of looked up, and it was we didn't have windows in this building because it was all top secret security. And so I'm just kind of looking up at the ceiling, and I just said, Lord, if you're really there, and if what's true is what's written here, please come into my heart. Forgive me of my sins. And I said something else. I said, Lord, please change me. And I felt the power of God. Of course, I didn't know what it was then, okay? I'm kind of reflecting back. I felt this like clean but not cold water just pouring all over me. And I felt like I was like standing a foot off the ground, and I felt this heavy load. I'd never read Pilgrim's Progress. I didn't know about that. So it, like this big 50-pound load just fell off my shoulders. And it's one of those experiences where you think it happened like, and then it seemed like it lasted forever. That's a God thing.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. Now, Nancy hadn't gotten there yet, but she was really praying for me because she knew I was a mess. But she loved me anyway. God told her to marry me. That's another story.
She was already a Christian then.
Oh, yeah, she was.
Okay.
Yeah. She was dyed-in-the-wool Catholic. She went all the way 12 years parochial school, but she told me her story about how when she was practicing for First Communion, how that she accepted the Lord in her heart. She says, I can't take this until I've accepted Christ, the repentant and asked Christ. And she was 6 years old when she
did
that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
She's
a neat lady. Yeah.
She is wonderful. But the Lord, I guess, began changing me. I didn't really realize it until about 3 weeks later. I mean, Nancy hadn't gotten there yet, but my old buddies that I used to go out with, they'd say, well, don't you want to go out with us? And I said, no, I just don't think I want to. They said, well, what's wrong with you? He said, you're just not the same person. Something's changed in you. What's going on? I said, and then it's kind of like chills went down my back, like, oh, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Like, okay. And it's kind of, and I started sweating, and I'm thinking, like, okay, Lord, you did answer my
flashback
prayer.
Flashback to that prayer,
like,
please,
whoa.
Change me.
And then it really hit me. And then I really repented. I think the first time was kind of like conviction repent. This one was like deep repent.
Repentance light.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So I know I've talked a lot about that, but.
That's definitely worth it, though.
I haven't spoken a lot about, but that's how my career in our calling. Actually, about a year later is when the calling came.
Okay.
We were in, and I know, and I'm going to be very vivid here. Not everyone, you know, God speaks to and calls people in different ways. And I guess I'm thankful to, in a way, that the Lord has spoken to me with visions and dreams.
Okay.
I know He doesn't do that for everybody. I mean, I guess He has to really get my attention. I'm so hard-headed. He has to make it really, really vivid, okay?
You're speaking to me. I will testify that I have had one dream that I know for a fact was from God. Only one ever, but He had to shake me awake, man,
because I just wasn't listening back then. That's all I can tell people.
Right.
They say, well, people... That's very rare for God to do that. Well, I'm a rare dude. I mean, God had to really, I mean, He had to take not a 2x4, but a 4x4 to hit me across the head. And so the first time it was a vision, and He showed, we were in a prayer meeting. At the end of the prayer meeting, we were praying for me to be filled with the Holy Spirit and just totally dedicated. And that's where I was. I said, Lord, I just want to totally sell out. I just, you know, it was one of those second works of grace kind of things that I didn't know that's what it meant. I mean, I was only a Christian for 6 months, maybe 3 months. Oh, I'd been a Christian 3 months. I didn't know all this terminology, like, you know, born again and sanctification and all that. I didn't know all that jargon. I mean, whatever the Bible said, what the New Testament was telling me and the Lord was telling me, I just did it. You know, that was it, you know. And, you know, I didn't know I was maybe going against some kind of doctrinal rule or something like that. like this was abnormal or something. I mean, to me, it was normal. And so the Lord showed me a vision of Himself first in heaven. And I'd never read the book of Revelation yet, but I saw the rainbow, and I saw the emerald throne. It was amazing. When I'm telling you right now, I see it. Every time I retell the story, I see it. I mean, you know when if it's God, if you remember all the details and you still see it in your mind. And so I saw this, and then I saw myself kind of like behind this church building. It was in the military over in Germany and in many other places, I'm sure, at that time, in those years, every Air Force base, every post had one or more chapels. And they were built, you know, typical kind of structure of a building with high, you know, gables way up, you know, in the eaves and so on and so forth. And I was hovering outside of this chapel, and then there it was kind of like up in the peak there, there was like a porthole, a spiritual porthole just kind of opened up like this. And I'm looking through, and then all of a sudden I'm inside. And I'm up on the balcony. I mean, I could see all the detail, the church and the altar in the back and two pulpits and the pews and maybe 20, 30 people sitting in the right-hand side. And there was a little pulpit there, and there was a man standing behind that pulpit. And all of a sudden it just zoomed in, and it was kind of fuzzy. And when it focused, it was me. I was standing there preaching to these people.
Hmm.
2 years later, I became the pastor of that small group in that very... It was not in Berlin. It was in a totally different city in Western Germany.
Okay.
But the Lord had shown me almost 2 years ahead of time that's where I was going to be.
Wow.
And I pastored that church. About,
now, were you still in the Air Force at that
time? Yeah, yeah. Okay. We had, at that time, there were different denominations like Baptist Union. There was some Presbyterians, a few Methodists, the Church of God. I was part of the Church of God at that time.
Okay.
And that was the fellowship group that I became a Christian through and grew and became called in Berlin. And so when I went there, this was actually about this place, this where this chapel was about 60 miles from where I was stationed. I was sent to another duty station on the Czech border. And we had to drive to a couple other places near Nuremberg, south of there. Yeah. We had to drive to get to the commissary, the PX, to buy stuff, you know. So about once a month, we would take a trip over there. Well, we went over there one day, and we were sitting there in the cafeteria, and there's this young couple. Now, we were young, 20s, young 20s. And we had a little baby, two babies, and they had a little baby. And they invited us over to their table because Nancy and I were sitting there talking about the Lord, about something. And they said, we heard you talking about the Lord. And so anyway, long story short, they went to this fellowship group, and they had been without a fellowship leader, a pastor, for 6 months. And they invited us to come over just to be with them. And when I walked into that chapel and I looked around, I said, deja vu. Yeah, this was it. It was exactly that exact spot.
Had it sunk in until that point, though? Or had, like... Okay.
No, as soon as I walked in, I knew that was it.
Right, but I'm saying like the time before that, though, had you kind of gone like, you know, like, was that how that was going to play out? Or
no, you got it. Well, first of all, my full-time job was I was a Russian linguist for the military, and I had a full-time Air Force job, and I had two small children and a wife. I mean, I was pretty, I had my plate was pretty
full. You don't
full.
Exactly have spare time, right?
Exactly. Right. So... even before that, the Lord, I was at this place back when I first prayed for the Lord and to come into my heart and forgive my sins. And I felt that power of the Lord come upon me. I was standing in that same spot about a year later. Now, here's the second part. I felt a hand on my shoulder behind me. And it was like my eyes, like a mist went over my eyes. Not totally. I could still kind of see a little bit. And then my hearing just went, and it was like silence. And the Lord said, someday I'm going to send you to Russia as a missionary. Literally. And he repeated it two more times. Someday, I'm going to send you to Russia as a missionary. Someday, I'm going to send you to Russia as a missionary. And then my vision comes all the way back.
Everything back to normal.
I'm looking around. I said, what's going on here? I mean, I don't think you can get much more specific than that and more definite than that. And that started a long process of course, I said, yeah, Lord. I mean, here, I got a top secret crypto clearance. If I tell this to my commanding officer or to even to my buddies, I'm going to be kicked out of the Air Force. I might be going to jail.
If you're not shot.
I might, like, Lord.
Wow.
And then I reenlisted. Our firstborn son was premature, and I had to stay over a little bit longer, and there was a place that needed a pastor, again, similar. This was before this other. And so I pastored a church in Darmstadt. It was a small fellowship group, 25, 30 people. So I was an itinerant missionary.
Okay, before, yeah, already.
Trailblazer, well, you know, kind of like a John Wesley, kind of, you know, on
set
my horse. I was a circuit rider because when the place I started pastoring two places, then when I got down to the other place,
wow.
The one where I went to, there was a second one, so I was doing two, and so we get back to Maryland to NSA headquarters. It was my last duty station, 1973 to 74. I was ready to reenlist again. We were sitting in a church service. We went to a church, and it was a very dynamic church. And I was ready to sign up and reenlist again for the second time. So I'd been in almost 8 years, and I loved what I did. It was a great thing. But the Lord said, "I want you to go home. I'm going to take care of you." So I come back to Indiana. Within 2 months, I'm pastoring 4 Methodist churches.
Oh my gosh. Hey, and Bill, I do just want to.
I know.
It's about one, and I know you said you
okay.
had to get out of here.
That's
at one.
Okay. If I go a little bit more.
Okay. Okay. Just making sure.
I know we haven't really talked, so I could say a whole lot more about that, but I'll just say that finally in 1993, we got on that big silver bird through OMS. We were not commissioned; we were career missionaries.
Okay.
We were sent to Moscow by OMS in November of 1993. November, 30 below zero and 3 feet of snow.
I think Jason's got a story about jumping off of a plane into Russia in the middle of the snow
as
well.
Yeah, yeah.
Just snow, a common denominator in Russia. Like, that happened a lot.
So OMS had given me 3 hats to wear when I got there, 3 assignments. One was to... if called to assist in the seminary, Moscow Seminary, I was to be the liaison officer for OMS to the seminary, back to OMS, and also to work with possibly organizing a denomination. Back then, that was our approach, was to start a denomination. An association that would become related and connected to OMS, which I did. I did plant a church with God's help and my wife, of course, in a Zelenograd, which was just outside of Moscow, and that was in 94. Then we helped to organize by 1998, we had organized an association. I'm not going to mention the name of it right now. It has changed, but I won't remember that. I won't mention that either. Started out with 7 churches. Now they have around 22 churches.
Okay.
So to a degree, bring it up to present time, there was a sort of a disconnect there for a few years from 2016 till just last year when the leader of that organization contacted me, still connected with the seminary, still connected with OMS, and asked me to help them, help him and other pastors to do the Train and Multiply launch.
Okay.
And actually, to bring it up.
Now explain what Train and Multiply is.
Oh, my. Well, of course, if you're going to multiply anything, if you're going to increase even, say, McDonald's or any other organization, you have to have leaders.
Right.
And the best way to start something new is to have leaders that can take on that responsibility. And so you train so that you can multiply churches, multiply right. disciples, multiply churches.
So it is a church multiplication tool.
It's a tool. It's a three-day seminar with about 12 different sessions, each session about an hour and a half. We took that to Ukraine in 2017. It was our first launch, you know, help them to launch a new work. Now, in many cases, in other fields of OMS, train and multiply has been going on for decades.
Yeah.
This was totally brand new for Europe in a way, totally brand new for Ukraine. Europe as a whole, up until most recently, has been pretty hard to bring the evangelical gospel to those people and for them to grasp it and use it. But the Lord had many years ago, actually in the early 2000s, had gotten me in contact with a couple of pastors in the city of Zhytomyr, which is about 100 miles west, slightly southwest of the capital of Kyiv. And by the way, just for everyone's information, don't want to get off track too much, just for perspective, the country of Ukraine is just slightly smaller than the state of Texas.
Okay, the landmass.
The landmass.
That's pretty good size, then.
It's very big, actually, except for if you do not count the western or the east, what is called the European part of Russia, which is anything west of the Ural Mountains, toward the west and north and south. If you don't count that part as, because that part is called Europe, because the continental gotcha. Divide mm-hmm. is right there at the Ural Mountains. So it's probably about 500 miles west, east of Moscow, the Ural Mountains start. Okay. So if you use that as a line, if you don't count the Russia-European part, Ukraine is the largest of all Europe, including Western Europe, larger than France,
well,
larger than Germany.
I did not know that.
Spain. Most people don't because it's never really been counted as part of Europe because it was called Eastern Europe, but it had always been a part of either Russia before or the Soviet Union. So we kind of – that was the line of demarcation. I mean, okay. It kind of – and so anything outside of the Soviet Union was considered Europe. Okay. Although we still called it Eastern Europe. We still called Poland and all those. But we never really calculated them in. It was sort of a psychological – to me, I think it's a psychological block where – we've just always seen that as, well, the Iron Curtain's there, you know,
right,
blah, blah, blah.
Right, right, right.
And so we didn't really think about it. So, but now that's why. And they have 44 million people.
Which I understand is about the size of California.
I know that Texas has, I think, what, almost 30 million. They have 44 million, I'm sorry.
So it's half again the population of Texas.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 44 million, right. Now, even before the war began in the 24th of February, there were already 2 million Ukrainians living in Poland, not counting where they may have been living elsewhere, in Italy or France or...
Not as refugees, just immigrants.
Not just they moved there, they lived there, they worked there. The economy was pretty difficult. And also this whole name called the Don Boss. You know what the, does anybody know what the Don Boss means?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you.
Are you talking like mafia? Like Don? That's what it sounds like.
I know. The Dons, you know.
Right.
But anyway, Don Boss. And they keep referring to this on the news, but and they talk about Donetsk and Luhansk. I have a little map here. You can see the yellow and the blue.
Right.
Those are the two regions. They don't. We would call them states, but they're not really as large as our states.
Okay.
For instance, the Zhytomyr region. If you look at the brown up here, where it says Bill and Nancy and all that. That's that region is about the size of Vermont.
Okay.
So it gives you a perspective. So if you have a bunch of Vermonts, they got 26 of them, okay? And so what is the Don Boss? The Don Boss, if you'll look, there is a river that runs through, starting with the yellow top, middle of the top middle, and runs and goes on into Russia. That is the Don River. And if you look down and it loops around, and if you look right here, you'll see the Don River here. So Bas is the short term for Bassin or Basin. So it's the Don River Basin.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
That's what the Don Bas is.
Okay.
Now that area over there is rich, super rich in all kinds of petroleum, coal, natural gas, and the primary, the bulk of the original gas pipelines that run to Europe run through those two places. All right, so you can see why that area is
so sought after.
Desired.
Is desired. Also, if you look way over to the west, where you butt up against Poland and Slovakia, Romania, there's the Carpathian Mountains. They're about like the Appalachian Mountains here.
Okay.
Right down there. But between, say, the Donbass area and mostly even down to the south, but almost all the way across, is kind of like going in and out of Kansas, Nebraska, some rolling hills like Kentucky. But I've been told that, you know, this real black, rich soil that you find, you know, in, say, some parts of Ohio through the central Indiana, you know, the Corn Belt.
Right.
And then you have the Wheat Belt. That is... this, as a matter of fact, the city...
It's the breadbasket.
It is. Ukraine has always been, historically, the breadbasket of either the empire or the Soviet Union. As a matter of fact, I've been told, and, you know, people can check this if they want, but that the 40% of the world's richest earth is located in Ukraine.
40%?
Wow.
That's what I heard. Now, I cannot check that. Maybe somebody who will listen to this will go, can that be? Okay, so that's okay. They can look it up.
Yeah.
But I've been told, but at least a very large percent. So it is also desired because right now, up until recently, in the recent years, Ukraine provides or has provided 30% of all of the grain that goes into Africa. That has been on the news.
That's incredible.
All right. So it's a rich country. Now, let me tell you about the people. Now, I haven't been all over the world. I've been to a lot of places. I've been to Singapore. I've been to Korea. I've been to Haiti, I've been all over Russia when we lived there in Moscow for 6 years. I traveled to the far – I didn't go to the Far East, but I went to Western Siberia. I've been to Volgograd, which used to be called Stalingrad, mm-hmm. the big – and seen the big monuments of the Stalingrad battle where nearly 2 million soldiers died, both sides together. Been to St. Petersburg many times, Moscow, of course, I lived there. But I would say of the people, and I've been to Germany, I've been to Spain, lived in Germany many years, I would say that at least in the Western, from Kyiv west, the people that I have met, they are probably closer, more like us in our values and our way of thinking. Hmm. Than anyone else that I've seen. They're gracious people. They're loving people. They are kind. They and very, very intelligent, and many of them are super educated. I mean, the pastors I know, both of them have either bachelor's and or master's degrees, seminary trained. I mean, the people are just so, so good, all of them I've met. I've been to Odessa, where now they're facing problems. Beautiful city, wonderful people. They call it the city of humor.
Humor?
Well, I'm sorry. That is the Ukrainian word, humor. Gorod yumora, they would say it. It's the city of humor.
Humor. Okay. All right. Gotcha.
Why do they call it that?
Well, back, I guess, in the 16th, 17th century, they had a port there, and they had the seafaring people from all over the world would come there. And they just developed this kind of a cosmopolitan, international kind of thing. and just everybody had to get along.
Yeah.
And French and Italian and Turkish and all these people. And this is what I've been told.
Little mini melting pot.
Mini melting pot. There you go. That's a good reference. Yeah. The Russian people are also good people. And that's one of the things I wanted to make a point, is that just like in the West, and even in our own country, the average person in America may or may not agree with what our higher political politicians are doing. And unfortunately, I know this pretty well, that many and most maybe of the Russian people are not getting the full truth of what's going on. And they would not approve of it.
Well, I just kind of assume that's what happens when I turn on the news at any point in time here in America as well. So I can't imagine it's much different anywhere else.
Well, it's to a greater degree. I'm sure. Much more controlled. And there is a slight, there are periods of history in Russian and Soviet history that have happened. People can look up the Great Hunger, they call it. In 1930, the winter of 1932 and 33, when 3.6 to 3.7 million Ukrainians died from starvation.
Whoa.
So people can look that up and find out all the details about that. So Ukraine, Belarus, Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah.
Also, the word itself, Ukraine, is made up of three parts. The root word is cry. And then you have the U in the beginning. And then you have the ina at the end. Well, you have a prefix, you have a root, and then you have a feminine, a name, noun, ending. So, Ukraina. Okay, So krai means borderland or frontier.
Okay.
U means at or on or of. And the ina is just the feminine noun ending on it. And so Ukraine has always been the frontier.
Okay.
And to some degree, it was a place where you sent undesirables. That either the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union would send. However, Catherine the Great, I believe that's back 200 or 300 years.
It's been a while.
She actually brought in folks from what would be called Slovakia, Czech Republic, and brought them in to settle the land and to farm the land in Central, okay, because of the grain. And she brought in a lot of those people.
She recognized the work value
ethic,
of the land.
The work ethic and the efficiency of the Germanic farmers, okay, and brought many of them into that area. There are also, of course, you know, it was called the Pale of Settlement, if you remember that in history. Most people don't.
I don't.
P-A-L-E. And the word P-A-L-E has a couple of meanings. One of them means like a border post, like you would drive a marker, okay, in the ground to mark your property borders, okay? And during various periods of time, the Jews, as depicted in one spot with the fiddler on the roof, where they were driven out of Russia, well, they were sent to Ukraine and to present day Belarus.
So did Fiddler on the Roof take place in Ukraine?
Or? I think it took place up in Russia,
okay,
and then they were sent further,
but that was
west.
The deportation, yeah, that they.
That was just one of many over many centuries.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And of course, it's fiction, but
that particular movie,
Fiddler on the Roof, is fiction. But
the actual
the deportation,
but
took
a
place.
Depiction,
yeah,
of that event or that type of event,
gotcha,
has a lot of historical,
yeah,
truth to it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it happened over a many period of time. I mean, and actually,
so was there a large Jewish population in Ukraine?
That's exactly right. If you look just below Zhytomyr there, it's written in Ukrainian, so you probably can't read it. There's a town there of about 40,000 people. I've been there. It's called Berdichev.
Just below the border there?
Just below Zhytomyr,
mm-hmm,
just above the green part there.
Mm.
Kind of got a little mark there and says,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Looks like a backwards D. That's a B.
Yeah.
Berdichev. And back in the time when there was a lot prior to the Nazi invasion and all that and the concentration camps, they say, I was told, we went there and talked to a lot of people, and some of the people in authority down there said, yeah, at one time 16% of the population was,
wow,
Jewish.
Wow.
And so there are a lot of – so they called that the Pale of Settlement, area or border area of settlement. And up to 5 million Jews lived between west of Kyiv and to all the way over to where Poland is and up into Belarus. That was called the Pale of Settlement.
Well, Bill, we're all aware of the war that's going on, Russia and Ukraine, and as we pray for them, we might pray just for some of the more obvious things. What are some of the less obvious things that you think we should be praying for as we pray for this conflict that's going on?
Well, it's interesting. We have our partners there in the Zhytomyr region, and I know that there are many other evangelical churches that are working. We have 30 partners that we work with, 30 different churches that we work with in our network. And they are all using the Train and Multiply to start new groups and things, mm-hmm, like that. So just before the war, if we call it the year prior to. We had 30 home groups. We had 7 new groups. We had 62 new conversions, people coming to Christ through those groups, not counting what was going on in the home churches.
Right.
Okay. These are just in the home groups. We had 29 were baptized. Now, for Europe, you got to understand, this is not India. This is not the Philippines or where you get tens or thousands or whatever of people coming to Christ. And this is just through the small groups. And 160 of the people, 265 people go to those groups. And then many of them are unbelievers. Of the 265, 105 are unbelievers. But through the groups, they are learning. They're doing discovery Bible study. They're doing times of prayer. And so people are coming to Christ. And so we have these churches that we need to pray for, not just if we're what we're doing, but there are many, many churches. People have been displaced. Not only have 5 million or more have actually gone into Western Europe and elsewhere out of refugees going out, but anywhere from 20 to 30 million, they're saying, have been displaced elsewhere within
the country.
Within the country. Mm. They've had to leave their area and go to another area.
Somewhere safer for the moment kind of thing. Yeah.
So we need to pray for that. We also need to pray for our Russian brothers and sisters too, because they are under a different kind of persecution. Maybe not physical, but it's possible even that some of them are being watched very closely, and some of them could be jailed or worse in Russia. They are trying to preach the gospel and do so. We need to pray for both sides really here.
Okay.
Also, I got reports of at least 4 of the people that we know personally that were from our network that were our refugees. One's in northern Germany, one's in Denmark, one's in Sweden, one's in the Netherlands.
Wow.
But you know what they're doing? They're doing ministry. They're just not going there and looking for a handout. They're going wherever they go. I've gotten reports back that they're doing translation work for the Ukrainian refugees for a pastor of churches.
That's great.
In their area. And one was actually a district superintendent, and he's up there visiting all these refugees in his area and in his within his realm, and going to them and praying with them and helping them. And one up in Sweden, staying with a Swedish family, she and her 2 daughters are there's a 12-year-old daughter of the Swedish family that they've led to Christ now and taking her to Sunday school.
Man.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So,
that's
great. They're not just over there. You know, I know it's a dire situation, but the people that we know who are Christians, and I'm sure there are many, many more that I don't know that are not just going over there and kind of with hat in hand and kind of crying all the time, but you know, they are crying. They are crying. Yeah. And they want to go back home. They want to go back home. But there, many of them are engaged in ministry, and I'm so proud of them.
They're making use of their time.
They are.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Such a story. That is fantastic.
Yeah.
That's awesome. We are almost at 1:30.
Oh, well.
So is there anything else you would like to hit us with here at the very end before we sign off here?
Well, I'd like to apologize for taking so much time.
No, we usually go forever.
We go for about an hour.
We were just trying to fit your schedule. Yeah.
Well, I'm already late, so you know.
Gotcha.
Well,
blame me.
Pray for Nancy and me. We are also displaced. We have a team of 8 resident missionaries from OMS that were living in Kiev and ministering in Kiev, and they've had to be evacuated. They were evacuated actually about a month ahead of the war. So,
and they're in Budapest now.
And most of them are in Budapest, and they are working with humanitarian supplies over there right now. And OMS has a project for that, and we are raising money, and they are actually just over, just since the war began, about 2 months now, we have already, they have already delivered over 142,000 pounds of food and supplies to the Ukrainians.
Awesome. That's great.
And when they go, what they do is they get the all the food and the supplies in two big vans, and they drive three times a week out to the Ukrainian border, which is about 3.5 hours away. And then they go across into Ukraine, and there's a sort of a reception area there where they can deliver it. And they can even sometimes specify, okay, please send some to this place, please some to this place. And so we have gotten a lot of the supplies even to Kharkiv, to those places that have been heavily bombed. And so it's getting, it's not just getting across the border and then just sitting there. I mean, it's getting into the country. And then our partners in Zhytomyr, they are taking their own personal vehicles and driving all the way to Poland, which is about a 12-hour drive.
Man.
And from where they live, and dodging bombs and bullets at least once a week, taking a van up there, getting food up there, and bring it in to Ukraine. But also in Budapest, we have a center where Randy and Shelley Marshall are one of our actually, the field leader of Ukraine, of our OMS Ukraine, they are basically running the reception center where when our team would go to drop off food, they would pick up refugees and bring them back to Budapest. But there is one good thing. I would like to also thank the people of Europe. I mean, they have done such a tremendous job. And if you're in Europe, if you're a refugee, you can go anywhere in Europe on a train or a bus totally free of charge.
Oh, wow.
Really? That's very cool.
My goodness.
And there are people in all the European EU countries and NATO countries that are opening their arms. And I truly want to say this. I believe that because of their generosity, God is going to bless them. God is going to bless Western Europe. And I also think something else is going to happen. And I think it's already happening. Not only are they opening up their arms and giving physically, but I believe God is now touching them spiritually. Mm-hmm. And I foresee the potential that Europe could be revived by the gospel.
Well, we'll send some over here afterwards,
yeah,
right?
That's right. That's right.
But
that's awesome.
But because of this, because people are opening up their homes, they're open. They're giving them food. They're giving them shelter. They're giving them, and all of Europe is giving them transportation, and they're taking in all these refugees, and they're. I mean, God is going to have to bless that. I just believe He is. And I sense it's kind of like the diaspora that happened in Jerusalem when, you know, everything blew up there in 70 AD with the Roman army coming in. And what happened? The Christians and the Jews had to run to other places in the Middle East and Europe to get away from that, and what happened?
They just kept evangelizing
wherever they went. That is exactly what is happening now in Europe.
How cool is that? That's so deep.
So we can't forget about that.
Yeah.
It's almost like a random mental picture here, but like almost like a dandelion. When you like blow the seeds off of it, they go and they plant more dandelions.
Hey, we ought to use that and train a multiplier. Well, I could say a lot more, but I just want to—I want people to know that the Russian people are not in control of this.
Yeah,
the average Russian, and that we need to pray for them, and especially for the Russian Christians who are trying to hold up the truth. They're still trying to preach the gospel. We need to pray. A lot of our people, our partners, are also taking food to the front. And they are also sitting back and making protective vests for their soldiers and taking them supplies.
Wow. Very cool.
To the front. So they're, the whole nation, they're
engaged.
Yeah.
That's a lot to be praying for.
Well, I'm sorry.
No, that's good. That's good. That means that God's people are at work, and on both sides, and that's a good place.
Yeah,
to
they're
have.
Working on both sides. That's what's a matter. And pray for Nancy and me, because we are looking. Okay, what if God? How are we supposed to participate in this? How can we? At the moment, we can't physically get back into Ukraine. We're hoping maybe by the fall we may be able to make a quick run in and. See, but, that's going to depend a lot on getting permission.
Right.
Not only from our government and their government, but from OMS. Hmm. We have to be careful.
Man.
So, but we have potential of looking into other areas of the Slavic world, and now that they've been dispersed all over the place, that maybe there are places that God could send us. So,
fantastic.
Awesome. Hey, Bill, thank you for coming on here and talking to us about your calling and what's going on in Ukraine and Russia and how we can be praying for them. And it's been cool to just listen and learn a little bit, because honestly, it's something I don't know a ton about. So this was awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. It was a privilege.
For any of you listening at home, if you've got questions, you can send those in to saltysaints@becomehope.com or questions@becomehope.com. And until next time, stay salty.
Have you ever attempted to read the entire Bible? Did you do it, or did you only make it partway? I'm John Stonge, and I host a podcast that will make it possible for you to make it through the entire Bible, one chapter at a time. I've been hosting the Chapter a Day audio Bible podcast since 2015, and every single day of the week, I read one chapter of Scripture, then follow that up with a time of prayer. And if you're looking for daily insights and inspiration directly from God's Word, I hope you'll give the Chapter a Day audio Bible a listen. You can find it at lifeaudio.com or on your favorite podcasting app.